Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal. I'm going to speak with you today with Lawrence Grierson, who's a colleague from McMaster University, my very own alma mater. He has a paper coming out in the July 2016 issue of Medical Education called The Relationship Between Perceived Preceptor Power Use and Student Empowerment During Clerkship Rotations, a Study of Hidden Curriculum. Lawrence is assistant professor in the Department of Family Medicine at McMaster and senior scientist in their Program for Educational Research and Development. Thanks, Lawrence, for making the time to talk.
Hey, no problem, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. It's a gorgeous day here in Vancouver as we slowly head into summer, but I'm sure you are ready to get your weekend started, given that it's Friday, so try to make this a little bit pithy, but wanted the chance to talk with you in large part because of the uniqueness of this paper, the relationship between perceived preceptor power use and student empowerment. The concept of power obviously is prevalent in medical education, but thinking about it from the use of how preceptors are using it and what it means for student empowerment isn't something that I've come across terribly extensively. Why take on these concepts at this point in time?
Okay, well, I think the first thing that I'll need to do is acknowledge my co-authors on this paper, Dr. Judy Baird and Dr. Kia Bracken, who are both clinical educators and clinical researchers with the Department of Family Medicine here at McMaster, and Judy's the lead author on this paper. The interest in this really comes from Judy and Kina's sort of mutual musings about the hidden curriculum and the impacts that it has on students' professional development and the way they identify with the profession of medicine. We came around to power and empowerment as useful constructs as we sort of struggled and found ourselves concerned with data and evidence that's coming out that shows that students are often finding themselves violating personal or professional ethics in order to please preceptors or to facilitate their own learning and things of that nature.
The work that you were doing or the experiences that you're observing that led you to that conclusion, did that seem to be driven by them feeling forced into these activities for reasons that they could rationalize, or was it really just a feeling of having to go along with whatever their preceptor was pushing them towards?
So in that regard, what we've viewed or perceived is evidence that's presented in literature. At this stage, I haven't personally observed this. Judy and Kina may have in their clinical activities, but you know, we've seen reports of an alarming number of students saying that they have participated in digital rectal exams on anesthetized patients, for example, without that patient's consent. Mm-hmm. You know, I can provide you that reference if you want me to dig it out and things of that nature. But there's also recent work that came out in your journal from the Ottawa group, who I think was Dylan Bold and colleagues, in a simulated scenario that showed that, again, students oftentimes violated professional ethics in response to directives from the preceptor. Why that happens? Well, you know, our study is a first step in trying to understand that, really.
And the focus on personal empowerment on the part of the student obviously implies that you see that as being a mechanism to try to start overcoming some of these less comfortable things. What should tell us about empowerment and how we might encourage that?
Yeah, well, empowerment is a useful idea, or at least we think it is, and we feel more confirmed that it is at the end of our study here. In social psychology, it is an idea that's pretty prevalent, and there they define it as the process that motivates an individual to, you know, identify as someone who can make decisions with autonomy. And again, in a lot of different contexts, in education and workplace and otherwise, it's been identified as a real positive predictor of, you know, pro-social behavior or ethical behavior. And the ideas that kind of come out from that social psychology work is that the successful promotion of values can be achieved by providing tasks to individuals in an education context that enhance their feeling of having impact. You know, if the task that I'm being asked to do is going to make a difference, that it's meaningful, that it relates to that individual's beliefs or ideals, or the organization's beliefs and ideals, and that fosters this idea of confidence that they feel capable of completing the task. And then that's something that's transactional between the person who's assigning the task and the person that needs to do it.
Oh, and they're obviously very complicated concepts that one can't simply pick up a ruler and study. How did you decide to start going about getting some traction on these issues?
Well, yeah, so we've got into the lit a little deeper around empowerment, and then, of course, power is sort of arose out of this. And we found a number of survey-based tools that aim to capture a student's perception of the types of power that the teacher is using, and also their perceptions of their own feelings of empowerment in the education space. So these two tools were the Teacher Power Use Scale. We settled on, ultimately, the Teacher Power Use Scale and a Learner Empowerment Measure. And so our goal was to administer these surveys to a large body of students engaged in clerkship activities at McMaster University, and, you know, in the simplest terms, to then correlate the relationship between the responses.
Can you tell us a bit more about the idea of preceptor power use? I can imagine there being any number of ways that can be used, and some positive and some negative. How does the instrument keep track of different ways in which power might be put in place?
Yeah, definitely. We skipped to the correlations before we talked about the idea of power, which is really, really important in this regard. So, you know, classically, power comes into the social psychology literature, into the education literature, via French and Raven's work in the mid-50s. And they really sort of started to delineate the type of power that can be used in social contexts in five types. But some widely perceived as pro-social, the use of expert power, which is that one has because they are knowledgeable and skilled and competent at the task which they have power over. Reward power, which is a classic example of if you do this, then you will get this, a good mark or a pat on the back or an ice cream cone, whatever it might be. And referent power, which is that which is really sort of associated with role modeling, typically. French and Raven also delineated a couple forms of power that, you know, are often tied to antisocial behaviors or considered antisocial. Now, the pro-social and antisocial thing, you know, I don't want to get too hung up on that because oftentimes these power uses can go either way depending on the context. But this is a normal situation. And those are legitimate power. And the example I always give for the legitimate power is to reference Steve Carell's character on The Office. If you've ever seen The Office, he's the assistant manager in a typical office environment. And oftentimes his directives come down because he has some legitimate power. I am the boss. Do this because I am the boss. Without any expertise or reason behind it. Oftentimes this legitimate power can also encompass this sort of perceived need for reciprocal action. You know, I've done something for you, so now you need to do something for me. And the classic one would be coercive power, which is do this or else. And in the medical education context, oftentimes that is you'll get a bad assessment or evaluation if you don't follow what I say.
Right. And did the theories you've been reading about lead you to anticipate that any one of those forms of power would be more related to empowerment feelings on the part of the student?
Well, we felt our hypothesis was that as perceptions of teacher power use in the pro-social domains increased, we would expect a likewise increase in the student's perceptions of personal empowerment in the environment, yes.
And any surprises in the data when you actually started looking at the correlations?
Yeah, you know, there were some surprises, but with respect to our primary hypothesis, which was that there would be a strong relationship between perceived power use and empowerment, we were confirmed that as the clerks reported seeing more pro-social power uses, the expert, referent, and reward types, their feelings of personal empowerment increased. And likewise, as coercive and legitimate power uses were exercised or perceived to be exercised by the students, their feelings of personal empowerment decreased. So no surprise there. That was what we hypothesized and had hoped to find. Comforting finding was, you know, our analysis of the types of power use perceived by the students showed that here at McMaster, the expert and referent reward powers were perceived as used significantly more often than the legitimate and coercive powers, which is really, really great news. You know, our DECs and our program directors really like to see that. However, legitimate and coercive power, you know, there were reports that it was being used. So there's something a little concerning there. So we took a secondary look at the data. And, you know, part of what we were interested in knowing is, does the organization of a clerkship rotation impact the way that this power use is displayed or manifested? And, you know, organization of a clerkship rotation is a really hard thing to get at a survey. But I think we came up with a reasonable surrogate. And what we did at the beginning of our querying of the participants was ask them to tell us what rotation they're on and to report the percentage time that they felt that their primary preceptor was a staff physician or a resident trainee, and with the assumption that the rotations where a staff physician is doing the majority of the precepting, we assumed that those were sort of flatter organizations. Whereas when residents or trainee level preceptors were being engaged, we felt that that was maybe a good indicator that there's more of a hierarchical structure within the clerkship rotation. And what we found, actually, to that was that as the time with the staff physician as preceptor increased, the clerks perceived more referent power being used, more of this role modeling power being used. However, in a concerning fashion, as the time with resident preceptors increases, that there was a concomitant increase in the perceived coercive power use, this antisocial power use.
And was variability in that regard seen across all the clerkship rotations, or was it typical that certain specialties were more likely to use the residents for the dominant preceptor responsibilities?
Yeah, the classic question at all the conference presentations comes to this. So one thing that we were really concerned about, Kevin, was not making this a specialty versus specialty inquiry. We didn't really have any a priori reason to believe that the actions that make up the clinical specialty would have any impact on this. So we didn't run the analysis as a function of specialty. We need more reason to get into that. We see that as being a politicized analysis, really.
Right. No, that makes sense. So I just was trying to clarify those patterns you were seeing were done with including all specialties lumped together.
Yeah, we lumped all the specialties. Now, these were just the specialties that were part of the core rotations for our clerks. So psychiatry, family medicine, obstetrics and gynecology, surgery, internal medicine. There's one more.
And speaks to your statement earlier about how power use is context specific, or the reactions to it anyway. What do we do with these findings now that we know there's an association that we anticipate we need to take into account, that power might be used in consistent ways and interpreted or influenced differently, or used very differently and interpreted the same way? How do we move forward from this?
Well, I think that the results of our study point to the idea that there's a need to understand the way that power influences empowerment and, you know, professional development for our clerks, that there does seem to be a relationship there. That's the first thing. You know, at a very superficial level, we can start to talk about the importance of resident education and academic teaching and student mentorship and even faculty development, really, you know, later stages. If power can be used to have positive influence, then we should be taking advantage of that. It may help us identify learners that are most vulnerable to ethical or professional violations, right? Learners that value obedience, younger learners, you know, there's probably a number of groups that this speaks to. I think the main thing that comes out of this is we're left with many questions. Our determination of organizational hierarchy, as I mentioned, is the surrogate, right? You know, does percentage time with a resident really reflect more hierarchical arrangement for a clerkship rotation or not? So we've been moving on with this research, and we have many questions to follow up on. You know, power is a transactional phenomenon. It changes encounter and context by context. So we want to explore the nuances of power use in the clinical environment, so that we can understand how clerks experience power and how that experience of power affects their learning. So what we're doing now is we're using the qualitative methodology of constructivist grounded theory, which is useful for studying social interactions and also useful when you don't know too much about a topic, which is kind of where we find ourselves. And we've also borrowed from anthropology and their ethnographic methods to focus on data collection efforts by observing clerks as they interact with preceptors and other members of the clinical team. Yeah. That's something we've got going on right now. We've engaged another scientist here at McMaster, Meredith Vanstone, who's an expert in those methodologies. And, you know, we have, you know, a young medical anthropologist that's on the wards right now, following clerks around and conducting ethnographic observations. Not anything that's happening with patients, though, because of all the ethical concerns that would go along with that. And this research is currently funded by the Canadian Association of Medical Education Wooster Family Grant, and internally here by our undergraduate MD program here at the Michael G. DeGroote School of Medicine.
Sounds great. I'm glad to hear there's more work to come, and I'm sure we'll all look forward to seeing how this evolves. Congratulations on this piece of work in particular, and thanks again for submitting it to Medical Education. I hope you'll convey our congratulations to your co-authors, Dr. Baird and Dr. Bracken, and we'll sign off by reminding our listeners that I've been speaking with Lawrence Grierson, who is one of the authors on the paper, The Relationship Between Perceived Preceptor Power Use and Student Empowerment During Clerkship Rotations, a study of hidden curriculum that will be in the July 2016 issue of Medical Education. Thanks, Lawrence, again for your time, and as I said, we'll look forward to hearing from you again.
All right. Well, thank you, Kevin. Thanks for all the great work you guys do with the journal.